I have had to completely rethink my perspective of pastoral care and my understanding of faith. I had a lot of help in understanding bereavement and grief with family. The seminary had prepared me well for the funeral, but had not prepared me to deal with the person who's still alive but facing death. From this experience, I'm convinced that the patient, and I'm going to continue to use the word patient, so I realize most of your fellow pastors and will probably be translating this into parishioners, but with your work in the hospital on a part-time basis, I hope you'll let me use the word patient. The patient is all too often caught alone in the valley of the shadow when his pilgrimage has died. This is, if you want to pick out one phrase, the patient being in the valley of the shadow and his pilgrimage is dying, that's the phrase that I would want you to share with you, because it's the model I use, the imagery I use. Now, if being caught alone is the tragedy of it, first of all, only half of the patients that we have worked with were actually told their prognosis by their physician. And yet, even though 200 of them had not been told, we found out from them, by listening, that they knew of their prognosis. They knew that they were going to die from this illness. How do they know? Doctors like to pretend that if they don't tell the patient, then they can keep it from them. Family likes to pretend that if we don't tell the patient, then he won't know about it, and none of us will have to get so uncomfortable. But what happens is a tunneling process in which, by various changes in behavior and attitudes and feelings, the person begins to become aware. A tunneling process underneath the surface. By the changes of the hospital routine, the treatment procedures, the attitudes of the staff, the attitudes of the family, the visiting schedule of people who come to see them, all of this begins to tell them a message. You're not going to make it. And one of my students came in the other day just before midterm evaluation and said to another student, a girl from Denmark, said, "You're another firefly." He said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You're not going to make it either." The patient becomes aware that it is happening with him. Out in California, they did a study in San Francisco of the nurses' response to the white light, you know, in the hallway. And they discovered that it took the nurses twice as long to answer the lights of patients who were terminally ill, who were known to be dying, than it did to answer the lights of patients who were going to get well. Now, I don't know about you, but if you've been sick, it seems, and you're living, it seems to be long enough to answer the lights sometimes for you. When the nurses were confronted with this, they denied it completely. And it wasn't until the sociologist pulled out the stopwatch recordings of how much time it took and the date that the nurses finally, their defenses broke down and they began to confess the frustration and the feeling of helplessness in going into the room of a dying patient. They were unaware consciously of doing any kind of discrimination in their response to the patient. But you see, the patients don't have those defenses. The patients are aware that the doctor is changing his response to the patient. They're aware the nurse is not coming by as often, or when they are coming by, they're not staying as long. They're much aware that something is different, plus the fact that there is a series of feelings and changes going along within the patient himself. He becomes aware that he's not able to do the things he was able to do. He becomes aware that there's changes going on in himself. In fact, this summer, I told you that I gave the summer off. I recommended the chaplain. But this was a little tough, didn't it? And one of the things I want to do in finishing up a book on the death and dying perspective is to look at Erickson's ego psychology principles, the epigenetic principle, where there's a built-in growth process within us, the program to grow. Maybe no matter what you do to avoid it, you still reach puberty, whether you like it or not. Now, there's an epigenetic principle at work in which we move. But I'm wondering if there's not an epigenetic principle in dying. And if this isn't part of the tunneling process, it's a built-in kind of a movement toward death in the process of illness. And it's really just as we have to remove the barriers, the social barriers, the interpersonal barriers, for the ego to develop. I think probably our real ministry is going to be removing the barriers to let the patient die. Let the patient die. But that's off the record. That's just something I'm struggling with. I'm going to go back to the tapes and materials to see if this works. Because whatever it is, the patient gradually becomes aware by his human ecology, the environment around him, and by what's going on in himself. We have yet, out of 400 patients, to meet one who didn't at some level of awareness tell us he knew that he wasn't going to make it. But unfortunately, he gets caught in being alone in this. Much too often, because he's forced to play the game of a conspiracy of silence. His human ecology, that is, the human environment around him, the staff and family, are unwilling too often to face that pilgrimage with him. And as a result, he finds himself alone in this valley, the only one there. While the staff and the family remain on the rim, looking down in the valley, saying, "We know you're there, fella, but we're not willing to come down and be with them." Now, the patient, time and time again, has told us we take our cue from others. We've taken our cue from the doctor that he doesn't want to talk about our illness. We've taken a cue from the family that they don't want to talk about the illness. The friends who come in, they don't want to talk about it. And so they become very polite and they don't talk with us about it. And we wind up playing this game where the doctor says, "We know the patient is terminal, but don't tell him." And the family says, "The doctor told us, we know that the patient is terminal, but don't tell him." And we walk into the room and talk to the patient, and the patient says, "I know I'm going to die, but I know that nobody wants to talk about it." And this creates a barrier of isolation. So that as the patient walks through the valley, in the last chapter of his life, he's forced, much too often, to go it alone. And what we discovered is that the pain of this aloneness is often far more anguish producing, far more hurt and suffering than the malignancy he has in his body. So you see, we can escape the reality that this person is going to die. We can see it very objectively. We can see it very impersonally, as most of us do. We don't have to get involved because we can escape into patterns of living. But the dying patient, as the tunneling process continues, has to admit at some level of awareness that it's happening to him. There have only been 3 patients who have maintained denial to the end, and one of them had to go psychotic to maintain this denial. The rest of the patients have had to face it, and often it has had to be alone. Now, I think one of the problems with this is that you and I, and the family, and the staff, tend to fall into the patterns of culture. And we live in a culture that seeks to avoid death. It's been described by some cultural anthropologists as a death-denying society. We see this in so many ways. We see it in the way we avoid aging, the way we emphasize youth. We see it in the way we have an assumed invulnerability that it happens to others but it doesn't happen to us. You talk to anyone who lived in Europe in World War II, or in Korea or Vietnam, and then you become aware that war and death and tragedy can come to you. But when you live in Clayton or St. Louis or Chicago, we can begin to assume that it doesn't happen to us. After all, God supports the psalmist, 10,000 shall fall at thy right and 10,000 shall fall at thy left, but it cannot happen to thee. As a kind of assumed invulnerability, we continue to smoke our cigarettes, we continue to get on our airplanes, we continue to drive our cars over the speed limit. It happens to other people, but it doesn't happen to us. We have a beautiful denial mechanism in our society. Our technology has enforced this, because we've assumed that what we haven't licked is just because we're having a fight ourselves to it. We can send men to the moon, and then if there's a mistake and a mechanical failure, we can apply our computers and our human skills, and we can find out a way to get them down. Even if it means putting a urine in an old oxygen tube and fabricating a piece of paper cartridge that we can take the carbon dioxide out of it, all unplanned and unscheduled, but even with them hundreds of thousands of miles away in that little $35 million sports shop, if we can get them back, pinpoint landing, even though all the best they've planned have gone awry. We in the 70s have earmarked that we will lift leukemia, we predicted we will lift cancer. We thought for a while that we could put transplants to hearts in people. And we have built a myth in our society that we can deny, that we can overcome any obstacle. And built into that is that if we can't lift it, we deny it. And death remains as something that we haven't lived, and that when we realize a thing, we deny it, the thing it isn't there. The funeral practices are perhaps the best example. Now, when I talk about the funeral home, if any of you have good friends who are funeral directors, why, I don't have to worry so much about clergymen with that statement as I do when I'm talking to lay people. Where I, on one occasion, to a business and professional women's group, two of the women were married to female directors, and I saw the women's liberation movement at work in church. But they're the top spaces. They're the recipients of our attitude. And I think they have sort of become the model of how this is handled. Over in Ohio, I noticed that they now have a drive-in funeral home. They went to the bank vault company and they installed extra large windows like the drive-in bank. And you can drive up and observe the body without having to get out of the car. That suggests that slides out to you and your John and Mary, seen by the funeral for George. And we don't have to get in the room with the dying person. Or the dead person. The dead person. What's more, we don't even have any place for dead bodies except the morgue. The funeral home only has slumber rooms. They take them as if they were sleeping. Of course, the epitome of that perhaps is out in California, where Ben Davidson, one of my colleagues, who teaches a course on death and death in American culture at the Divinity School, is telling about Forrest Long's latest venture. He can now plan your wake ahead of time in just the setting you want. If you want it to be a family room setting in a lounge chair, they will arrange your body in a lounge chair in front of a TV. If you want it to be your bedroom or wherever you want, they will arrange it for you to be placed in the position you want. I suppose, gentlemen, if you insist, they could put a pulpit in there while you're standing behind it. That's the way you want to be remembered. And from some of the sermons I've heard, that's where some ministers belong. What's more, you can take record beforehand what you want to say to people who come to your wake. So if they can push the button, but raise your voice, push a button and you will talk from your favorite setting to your beloved. Now the only way I'm willing to do that is if I can have selection. One for my bishop, one for my in-laws, and one for my friends. But it's all our way of pretending that it hasn't really happened. It's our way in society of pretending that death doesn't really exist. Some of you may be familiar with Dean Joseph Matthews, who's at the Ecumenical Institute. He was one of my old professors down at Turkey. And a few years ago, he lost his father, and he wrote an article that came out in Motives and the Ecumenical Institute Journal, and is now also a chapter in the book that Milton Scott edited on the vision of death. Let me read how he described his experience, for I think it epitomizes what we're talking about, and I'm sure you'll strike familiar chords in your own memory as past is written with the reed and with the same being. The family desired the experience to be one of dignity when the father died. To symbolize this dignity, the family desired to quote, clothe him in a fine bath and to rest him in the raw earth. Having been told the task was ranged from $100 to several thousand dollars, they asked for the $100 coffin. when we got a talk and they tried to assign a Sunday paper. Why, the one you mentioned. Oh, no, 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 no. Cost could begin at $275. Did you not mention a $100 coffin? Oh, yes, yes, but you wouldn't want that. It's the coffee. We only bury coffins in a $100 coffin. With persistence, the family with these were met by getting a less experienced employee to go back to the warehouse where they found one of the pine boxes. And they selected it. And later, Tim Matthews described the experience after his father's body had been placed to care by the indigent. These are his words. My father, I say, was 92. In his later years, he had wonderfully fizzled drinking. I had left the kitchen there. His cheeks were deeply sunken. His lips pale. He was an old man. There's a kind of glory in the face of an old man, but not so with the stranger lying there. They had my papa looking like he was 52. Cotton stuck in his cheeks at a rate the best wrinkle. Makeup powder and rouge plastered his face, way up into his hair and around his neck and ears. His lips were painted. He looked ready to step before the light of a matinee performance. Later, at the cemetery, Joe remembers this. I say I smelled the sulfur. There is none to be seen. What I did see is difficult to believe. I mean the green stuff. Someone had come before us and covered that good, wonderful, raw dirt, every clod of it, with green stuff. Everything, every scar of the grave was concealed under simulated grass. Just as if nothing had been disturbed here. Just as if nothing were going on here. Just as if nothing were happening here. What an offense against nature, against history, against prophet, against us, against God. The banks of flowers upon the green facade only added to the deception. Was it all contrived to pretend at this last moment that my father was not really dead after all? Was it not insisting that death was not important, not bestowed upon us by the final one, not a lively part of our lives, not fairly human? Suddenly, the great lie took on cosmic proportion. And suddenly, I was physically sick. How difficult it is for us, for you, or I, or a parishioner, or patient, to go against the stream of a death-denying social climate and need. And how difficult it is for us if we want to bring back any kind of dignity to the process of death. But if the funeral home is a test station, then you can say that the hospital is a microcosm reflecting these attitudes. It's a miniature world in which the patient dies of the same death-denying attitude within the community. 53% of our people in this country now die in hospitals. And if you add to that the vast number of people who reside and die in geriatric centers, homes for the aged, senior citizens, villages, you will realize that the place of death for our society is often removed from the familiar. And they die in a foreign land. And if they should die in a geriatric old folks home, perhaps that's home for them. But the family must face this process as aliens in a foreign territory. And most of our hospitals are hardly prepared or equipped to help the patient die with dignity. First of all, the hospital focuses on healing, not death. Our hospitals have been in existence 43 years, and we are yet to have a patient die in our hospital. We've had a few stops, but we haven't any died. It took us 15 hours a week to find a dying person and send me a person. Because you go to a floor and they just didn't have anyone down. Now it takes us about 15 minutes a week to get a patient and they come from the floor. But that's been a process of 4 years of communicating to staff to live our life to talk about sending it. And if there are some constructive, creative things that we can do when a person is walking through the valley. But I'm amused at the various ways in which these programs are titled. This is about my 52nd presentation on death and dying since we started the project. I haven't nearly caught up with Elizabeth, and she's at about 110. But I'm amused at the various ways in which they want to talk about it. We have one group of doctors, the medical society, and the doctor suggested that they call it death and dying. But oh, no. And the closest they could come was to call it management of the terminal risk, which is the same title they use on this network for video tapes, which you mentioned you saw that year. We don't want to use the word. I refuse and schedule to hardly accept to deal with the terminal risk. Take your expensive care in this, for example. I'm sure you have in the hospital, so you will. And take your care in it, ours is now up to $132 a day for that delightful atmosphere. The 10 beds, all in open wards with seats pulled around, And all geared to the finest of physical care. We've got $150,000 worth of equipment in there. Just the lights over the bed for $1,200 a piece. But the human dignity that is stripped away. For example, the families are allowed in there only 5 minutes out of the hour. And you know, I have yet to find a family who reason or grief, to paraphrase grief cycles on the 55-minute hour. They spend their 55 minutes waiting for the next visit in a dull, institutionalized waiting room, where they sit and wait until they can come back to the next 5 minutes. Some of you may have seen the article in Life magazine back in November, where we had the 6 pages of a young 21-year-old girl dying of leukemia. But she had a partial remission and then came in just after Christmas with a rare kind of pneumonia. There's only 59 cases in the world. And we had hoped that the doctor had suspicion what it might be, and they took a pulse out of the lung and turned out to be in the sleep and sent our drugs up from Atlanta and hoped that we would work that she needed 16 more hours for the drugs to know whether the drugs would take effect in combating this type of pneumonia. And 4 o'clock New Year's morning, she died, 16 hours short of knowing. Finally been told at 4 p.m. that afternoon that she wasn't going to make it. It's just a matter of time. She's getting only 28% of the necessary oxygen if you run a few dollars said to need it. Yet she maintains consciousness until soon when she just closed her eyes and sleep. So she come in, a 21-year-old girl, just engaged, a beautiful girl, just smooth, lying there in the bed with no sheets, nothing on it but the tubes and all the gadgets. Pulled her feet up, and the next time the family came back in, here was her lovely daughter, again, no modesty, the various things that you and I know of and share in the most intimate circles are suddenly public. And if I may move from the more serious of this young girl to my own experience to illustrate it, it's a little more humorous because I did survive. But at the time, a year ago, November, I wasn't sure I would, and I ate some chili in our cafeteria. And I got as far as the emergency room on my way home and spent 2 days in the hospital itself. So, when I write it, that has a particular sense of mythology, gentlemen, if you haven't been through it. It's a certain agent existential pain and cause of nature. And I'd look to my left and I'd look to my right, and there was no bedtime to be seen. And I hoped that a nurse would come in. Agency became, began to be more and more existential, and became more and more real. I finally broke down and pushed that little button for the light. And then the wall would begin to speak to me. May I help you? And you know, ever since I was about 2 and a half years old and in church one Sunday, said to my mother, Mommy, I got a potty. And I was taught that you don't say those kinds of things in public. I had very good credit training. And why do I have to tell the whole world that I need a book bag? I don't know who's back there behind that wall where that little speaker goes. All of the modesty and the privacy and the kinds of things that we share suddenly become public, and our dignity stripped away. But a dying face just has it all the more. They now have a modesty. The things they've known, the things they've loved, are all stripped away by the routines of our hospital. And I'm not saying that that little wall judgment isn't necessary. I know our nurses' legs are short and the distance is long and the talk is far. But if you get so impersonalized a practice, Dr. Ross and I, in reflecting on this experience New Year's Eve, and I've never had a New Year's, and I hope I never have another New Year's Eve like that. But we thought how nice it could have been if we could put a little dignity in the process. And at 4 p.m., the doctors knew it was hopeless. She could have been transferred to a private home where her family could have sat beside her with just the minimum of respiratory equipment that they needed. And there was something to see some dignity. This girl could have had the last moments of her doctor lived with her family. During that time, she had had an intensive care unit while her family was there only 5 minutes out of line, two cardiac arrests of other patients. So the staff leaned into their building, broke their curtains around how they saved the lives of two others, one whom they did save and one whom they didn't. But the dignity, the privacy, the peace, the community, it could have been theirs. They could have had a familiar setting of their family sitting beside her. I don't know whether it would have meant anything to her or not. I know each time she came in, she took her hand and clasped it. I knew she was aware we were there. What else she was aware of, I don't know. But the last chapter that we have in life, we so often have in a foreign land, where our family, our aliens, it's unfamiliar, it's unknown, and often so undignified. But I hope that not only is our setting, we are prepared to deal with the dignity of dying and helping our people in the Valley of the Shadow. Our training is so we are prepared. As I indicated, I had a lot of help on grief work, the recent work, but very little on preparatory grief, very little on knowing how to talk and how to listen to a dying patient. We find that most of the professional training in the secular world is on don't get involved. And Nancy said, don't let your feelings get in the way. We still orientate our volunteers to two things don't talk about, religion and politics. We're not supposed to upset a patient. And yet, when you're working with a dying person, if you don't get involved, then something is wrong with your humanity. It doesn't mean you let your feelings get in the way, but if you somehow, become prepared to listen and sensitive to what's happening, and don't be afraid to get involved. Our past experiences sometimes get in the way. I don't know what your experience has been working with dying patients, but I shall never forget a physician who told me why he doesn't have his patients to see. This is in Georgetown on a panel, and he said, I told one patient very early in my career, and because I saw that patient to speak, I never saw another patient to speak. It was a friend of his in St. Gosworth, who also treated. He developed a voice in the doctors to open him up and metastasize and close him back up. The patient had said all along, the voice, I want to know the truth about this. I don't want you to hold anything back. And so after the surgery, he came back down and knew he was up there in a short time. He had a hunch that they didn't do anything. And he first the doctor saying, I need to know, I have things to do, things to take care of. And the doctor said, well, there wasn't. He felt willing to entrust with this relationship, and he said, well, there wasn't really anything you could do. It's metastasized, it's spread. We're going to do all that we can, we're going to do some radiation on an outpatient basis, but there's really not much else we can do except to make things as peaceful and as comfortable for you, and we'll stick with it. He thanked the doctor, and as soon as he stepped out, he went home and blew his phone down. And that doctor said, I'll never sanitation again. He says, what comes to my mind is the place that he said, I have things to do, and thank me to come. And I remember what it was like to attend the funeral and be with friends of somebody I had told that he was dying. All doctors to be admired for his honesty. Other doctors tell me honestly, as one surgeon in our hospital said, I can't talk to the patient about these things. He said, when I'm in that operating room and scrubs, and I have in front of me a body on that table, and all I have exposed is that little area that's to be operated on and everything else green, he says, I've got to concentrate on what's there. If I begin to think that this is a 35-year-old woman, a lovely woman who has half her lifetime to live, who has three small children and a wonderful husband, and if I begin to think about if I do or if I don't succeed, those three children are going to be orphaned or without a mother. That husband's going to be widowed. I can't operate. I have to keep my attention on what's there. I admire that fact. Not because of that attitude, but because of his honesty, that he knows that his feelings are such that he can't cope. Our feelings, you see, I think, are the major problem that pushes the patient into the valley of the shadow. We have not learned how to deal with our own feelings about death. We have not learned how to help our parish members, our community people, our constituents, our hospital staff, to be with us. We haven't even learned how to recognize our own feelings about dying, about another person dying. One of the basic built-ins to our seminar on death and dying is that following the interview with the patient's taken back to the room, and we go behind the window glass with the seminar people, and the first thing we ask for are gut feelings. What do you feel down here? Not a fear. Down here. And how difficult it is for the medical students, seminary students, social work students, inhalation therapy students, nursing students, or professional people graduated to know what we think. The answers are, I thought she was bluffing. I thought she was 30 years old. Or as we say in New Orleans, Friday when we interviewed on live video remote to an auditorium, the people told us, we thought this guy was controlling things. Yet then you have to ask another question for that student. How did you feel if you thought that this person was controlling? Or how did you feel if you thought that this woman was denying? Well, I thought this person said. Well, how did you feel if you thought such and such? Well, let me use the word feel. I felt that she should have said something about this. And, well, how do you feel that she should say something about this and didn't? We have in our civilized society built so many filters against our feelings. We had a 37-year-old black woman return to our hospital having been unacceptable through IV dialysis program, limited government draft, with Washington government signing of it every month, and we have to be very careful about the patient. We sent her off to two other hospitals, and she sent their dialysis program test too. So here she was, 37-year-old, black, single woman, who had her death warrant written. She flunked in because she was black, poor, and of little social value. She was single and had no children. And her death warrant was written because without dialysis, she could not continue to live. And we have over 200 patients awaiting kidney transplants in Chicago alone. And we just don't have that many donors. So she was referred to us because the doctors didn't know how to cope with the fact that this woman was literally being killed by a society that could not find the funds to provide for dialysis for a black, poor, single woman. In the seminar, she talked about her concerns. And one of her concerns was, what assurance do I have of being accepted in the next garden when I've been rejected in this garden? She saw the rejection of the dialysis program as the rejection of life. And if she looked for something beyond life, she said, what assurance do I have that there's something beyond, that I will be accepted? about a moving interview. I was very upset. He went back in the other room. Of the 50 students, he got there. 8 of them spoke up fine without their gut feeling. And all 8 of them said he turned them out. They had no feeling. He said, that was Jesus' thing. Well, I blew up, as I meant to do. So I was furious. I was angry at society. I was angry at this hospital. I was angry at the world. But a woman like this, who was such a beautiful person, was being, I said, murdered. Not overtly, but definitely being murdered. I was angry with her for making me so upset, and I was angry at myself for getting upset that she was making me upset. Well, that did it. That blew off the lid. And then the gut feelings came out. She wouldn't turn them off. But the feelings of frustration, of helplessness, and the most common feeling that came out was the feeling of total helplessness. Nothing we could do. And because that was an unacceptable feeling, we backed off, gave some distance, and said, just on the end. Very often, you and I as pastors hide behind the mask of theological language, of priestly functions, of chit-chats, of neutralization, because we can't let ourselves get close to the dying patient, because the dying patient reminds us how hopeless we are to be. And very few clergymen I find are comfortable being helpless. In fact, the feedback from this New Orleans program was if several guys got up and spoke, they were all full of darkness, but no focus there, so not really. Not leaping brothers. But they got angry because we let the patient control the energy. Why did they get angry that we let the patient control the energy? Because too many pastors feel the need to be in control. In our counseling, in our prayers calling, in our work with dying patients. And when you're in control, the patient picks it up and plays the game with you. And if you don't want to talk about it and want to spend your time talking about prayer's responsibilities, that's what you're doing. You may not be meeting their needs, but they'll meet yours. Check your gut reaction. Because the gut reactions are the real key. How you feel. I think the good Lord gave us gut reactions to the life, and we can either learn to use them or we can abort them. You learn to use them, you learn to know how you're feeling about something, and you can then check that out as a way of turning your feelings into stepping stones to relate to the person. I'm convinced of this. I've also found that very often it's difficult for us to recognize that this pilgrimage through the valley comes in stages. I call these dramas. And I'm going to close with this and then pick up this afternoon with some more of the uniqueness of the patient. But if I can very briefly list what I see as the dramas that the patient goes through, they're essentially the dynamics of grief work, as you find in any time, especially any kind of loss, because they find particular meaning for the dying patient. Dr. Ross refers them to them in the book as stages. Now, if you've read the book, you don't count on the book for the notes because I changed them a little bit. The book was written 2 years ago, really, in terms of a manuscript, and I think we've learned some things these last 2 years. But the stages, as I see it, are actually polarities, continuums, from which we go one way or the other. The first drama of stage, as I see it, is the drama of denial versus panic. Denial versus panic. That's the point in which the person is introduced to his diagnosis and prognosis. Question not me for the denial or the oh no, oh God, it's me, the panic. Shocking denial of the healthy, the therapeutic, the constructive, the natural kinds of reactions to sudden shock. You hit your thumb with a hammer or hurt, but there's a momentary period of numbness before the pain hits you. Within the word that you have a malignancy, there is initial denial, no, it's not me. It's that patient down the hall. We both went up for biopsies at the same time, and boy, he looked like he was dying, and they got the report confused. And the pathologist laughed. Not me, it can't be me, oh no. If you take the denial away, you force them into panic. And you force them into a flight just because they don't have any shock absorbers to twist it, the reality. One of the patients of the three that maintained denial by going psychotic was an example. He went over to a neighbor and told a neighbor, it can't be that they told me there's no hope, there's no way I can continue to live. He's 28 years old, three small children. The neighbor said, God can help you. Took her to a faith tabernacle. The faith healer laid her hands on her head and she was healed. Unfortunately, the next day, a Saturday, her husband came home after serving up about noon and found her lying on the floor, instead of rolling, and the three children on the floor eating peanut butter out of a jar with the diapers unstained, completely psychotic. He brought her to an emergency room and dropped her and went on home. And she called for me that evening, and I came in to see her, and she said, I'm healed. It's so wonderful. God has healed me. And for the 6 weeks she had left in life, she maintained her psychosis. The reality was so tough that she escaped into a world of fantasy because she was not allowed to maintain denial. Denial is appropriate, it's healthy, we all have it within limits. But as the body and the social relationships begin to change, most of us become aware that it's happening to us. Sometimes it's the process that begins to cause the denial where we compartmentalize our feelings, but are able to talk about it. You see this often with your parishioners, where they'll talk about it, use the word intellectually, but you get no access. But very often this is a process by which they then begin to move from not even being able to talk about it, to being able to talk about it and not feel it, to being able to feel it. The second drama that they move into, if they're able to move through this first drama, is to one of anger, or if they're not allowed to express their anger, they move to depression. It becomes a question of why me. But it's a why me, not wanting a theological answer from you at this time, but wanting to someone to say it's not fair, and wanting them to find comfort in the 22nd psalm, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? It's where reality sinks in, and it becomes an issue of why me? Why not the man down the street that doesn't take care of himself or his wife or his kids? Why me when I've gone to church all my life and been good and tried to keep healthy? Why me? Why not that louse or that criminal or someone else? Now, I've referred to this in loosely terms, gentlemen, as catharsis versus constitution. From the few things I remember of Luther's table talk and so on. But either they're able to get it out and express it through catharsis, through anger, through ventilation, or they have to hold it in and they turn it inward, the anger inward upon themselves, and it becomes depression. The key to this is the person's ability to express feelings. His ability to express feelings, and particularly his ability to sanction negative feelings. We have two kinds of control on negative feelings. One is the internal control that we have upon ourselves, that we can't be angry, or we can function anger and we can be angry at others. And the external control of our family, of our friends, of our hospital community, of our pastor. And if we preach often enough that being angry is sinful, and we forget that the Bible says be angry and sin not, it doesn't say don't be angry. If we can help the person recognize that the opposite of love is not anger, but the opposite of love is indifference. If you don't believe that, think how many times a little boy will get in a fight or will spill his milk or something to get his parents' attention. He can tolerate punishment more than he can tolerate being ignored.